Today is June 4th, 2014. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing Gretchen Millick, who worked at WKAR, the public radio station here at Michigan State University, for how many years, Gretchen?
For 23 years.
23 years. A mere short time, I must say, from my point of view. I would like to start with your childhood. Tell us a little about that childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings, parents, and any special memories from that time in your life.
I have many special memories.
Good.
I was born in Detroit at St. John's Hospital, and I grew up in Detroit, and I went to Detroit Public Schools and got a fantastic education. And my father worked for the city of Detroit.
What did he do?
He was a social worker.
Uh-huh.
And he was there during the time of urban renewal. Uh-huh. And he worked with Zoltan Ferency, was also there.
Oh, really?
And together they relocated people out of many homes that were torn down. And then, you may remember, they built big projects,
right,
which became very controversial after a while. But at the time, I remember they thought they were doing the right thing. And my mother worked for the state of Michigan for the Treasury Department. She also worked downtown.
Oh.
And so a lot of times, you know, during the summers and stuff, I would take the bus downtown and tool around down there and visit the folks and have lunch and stuff. And it was a lovely childhood. We had a great neighborhood, and we played outside all day long like kids used to do. And
did you have a lot of street games, or did
you
go to the parks, or what?
We played street games. We had we played badminton in the street, and we also there was a gang of us, and we would ride our bikes around the neighborhood and go up to the candy store. And we also started, when we got to be a little bit older, putting on plays in the garage. And we would invite the neighbors and put on plays. And then I actually started doing radio plays. I got a tape recorder. And we would write these plays, and we would act them out and do all the sound effects and everything. And a friend of mine, I'm still friends with several people from that era, and she dug out those old tapes and played them last summer. And we laughed our heads off until we were just crying. They were so funny. They were just a riot.
Now, you said, you kept saying, we did this and we did that. Does the we refer to your siblings? Did you have any siblings?
Or? Yes. I had an older sister and an older brother and a younger brother. My older brother was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was 20. And we did not, we didn't hang out much together as kids. I mean, we did take family vacations and things like that. We spent a lot of time going up north. Two of my aunts had cottages up north, one in East Jordan and one near Charlevoix. And so we would go up there and, you know, just run around as kids did. At one of the cottages, we formed these gangs, the girls against the boys. And
who usually won?
Well, I hate to say it, but the boys, because they built like traps and they had spears and weapons and things like that. They would capture us and try to make us eat frogs. It was a wonderful childhood, I guess I have to say. But mostly I hung out with my friends. I had three girlfriends who lived on the block, and we did a lot of fun stuff together. And, you know, also in school, school was, at that time, I know Detroit Public Schools totally get a bad rap, but at least at the time, it was wonderful.
So that would, if you had no horrible experiences
Well, I was, when I got older as a teenager, during the summers, I worked as a lifeguard for the city, at one of the city pools. And that was a real education for me.
In what way?
Well, because at the time, there was a Black Panther house that was across the street, and the Black Panthers used to come over and swim. And it was the first time that I actually sort of learned about really the kind of racism and, you know, the circumstances that Black people really faced in trying to make it in the world. And I became somewhat politicized.
About, can we pinpoint the time?
That was in the 60s.
In the 60s, yeah. The early part of the 60s.
Yeah. And then while I was working there was also during the riots.
That's what I wondered.
And I had been, for the first part of the summer, I was over in Palmer Park, which was on the west side of the city, and we lived on the east side. And Palmer Park was a place where there were snipers, and it was sort of in the midst of the riots. And when it started, I was actually at work, and we went inside and hid under the desks, and the National Guard was landing in Palmer Park. And my father, against all advice, drove across the city to pick me up. And just, you know, we drove through the city and saw everything happening. It was just amazing. Oh. Yeah. It was very, very sad.
And that's a very strong memory. I remember those times.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else about your childhood?
About my childhood.
Or your relationship to your siblings or your any specifics about the public school education that you are speaking so highly of?
Well, when I was in 10th grade, I had a counselor there who I was getting all A's in school, but at that age I was starting to kind of date and get into trouble occasionally, that kind of thing. And I started skipping school sometimes. And
what we call playing hooky.
Playing hooky, exactly. And this counselor was really sort of took me under her wing, and she said, you know, you ought to think about going to a different school, because she wanted me to get away from the people I was hanging with. And so she arranged for me to get a scholarship to a private school where I went for 11th and 12th grade.
Oh. And did you notice a marked difference in the environment, the ambiance of the private school compared to the...
Yeah, because there was a lot more monitoring of what the kids were doing and what I was doing, too.
I see.
And the other thing that sort of marked that time, that was during the Vietnam War also. And a good friend of mine, at the same time that my brother was killed, her brother died in Vietnam. And we became, you know, at that point became aware that we were against the war. And, you know, started demonstrating and went to New York and Washington for marches and things like that. Bless you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It's always twice. So you lived through some exciting historic times, mm-hmm. actually.
Yeah.
Tell us about your college education, things like where you went, what you majored in, what your goals were at that time.
I went to the University of Michigan. And I majored in, well, they had a major at the time in radio and television. And I did some theater on the side. But at that time, I really, really got interested in it. And I had some wonderful professors who were very encouraging. And I didn't study journalism until I got into, you know, as a junior and a senior, because I didn't think that that's what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to do production. But then I got interested in journalism. And my parents had always listened to WDET in Detroit. It was a classical music station at the time. And I just thought I would like to work for public radio. You know, that would be fantastic. And but when I got out of college, I got a job at a TV station in Cadillac, Michigan, because part of it was radio. I did the weather on TV. It was the weather girl, they called us at the time, instead of a meteorologist. But I certainly was not a meteorologist. And then, but then I would do the news on radio, and I really liked that part of it. And living in Cadillac was interesting. That was where I sort of started to love doing skiing and getting outdoors. And, you know, I lived on a little lake, and it's very, very much an outdoor kind of culture up there. And so that sparked my interest in outdoor
stuff.
So
that was far different from the urban life that you grew up in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very different. Very different.
So it opened a different world for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long were you in Cadillac?
Just a couple of years. I was young and looking for more adventure than Cadillac offered. And so a friend and I took off for Washington, D.C. And when I got to Washington, I worked as a waitress for a while. I was the world's worst waitress.
So you didn't make it a lifelong occupation.
I did not. But I had had this radio experience, and so I applied to WEMU, not EMU, that's the Eastern Michigan station here, WAMU at American University in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the job, and I hosted the morning program. And this was before Morning Edition started. Morning Edition, at the time we had a show, and it was kind of unique. It was called Morning Line, and we did 2 hours local of, we had NPR news at the top of the hour, but then we would fill in with our own features, our own interviews, we'd have music, and I would try to do a live interview every morning if I could arrange it. It's hard to get people to come in that early. It was from 6 to 8 every day. And that was, you know, that was just a blast, although that morning shift ruins your social life completely.
I can believe it. I can believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a late night shift would do the same.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And radio, in a lot of ways, is, it's, the scheduling is always something that interferes with your life, because unless you get someone to fill in for you, you can't take a day off. And so you have to plan everything around that. And some people find that really grueling, because it's every day, every day. And you have your deadlines every day. And, you know, you got to be there and you got to do it. And so a lot of times I thought, well, I want to get out of this because, you know, I want to go out and have fun. And
you wanted greater freedom.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So given all that, what brought you to East Lansing?
Well, I had gone to law school. After I left AMU, I hopped around to several different jobs. I worked for the Chuck Robb campaign in Virginia when he ran for governor. And it was a great time because I traveled all over Virginia and met people. And a lot of times I was traveling with people who were spokespersons for Robb, and they were inevitably lawyers. So I talked to a lot of lawyers during that time, and I decided, well, I'm gonna go to law school. This is interesting. So I went to American University Law School, and while I was there, I started clerking for a firm that was right across the street from NPR. And while I was there, I found it horribly boring. I had to drink tons of coffee all day long just to stay awake with the work that I was doing. But part of what we did, this was a communications law firm, was I would go over to the FCC every day to check on the licenses that our clients had applied for radio and TV stations. And I noticed one day that there was a new frequency available in northern Michigan. So I applied for it myself. And there was only one other applicant, and it was a national religious organization. And they were snatching up frequencies so they could air their national programs on them. And so I just kept a watch on it. At that time, it was only a few hundred dollars to apply for a license. Now it's much more expensive.
What does the license give you?
It gives you the legal permission to broadcast, to build a radio station and to broadcast.
For 24 hours?
Well, it depends on the license, but this one was 24 hours, yeah. At a certain frequency and, you know, but there's a lot more to it because that's just a license. It's nothing, there's nothing
then
there,
really.
Then
you have to establish the whole organization.
So then I noticed that the national religious organization dropped out, so I was the only candidate, and I realized that I was going to get the license. So I had to tell my law firm that I had done this. And when I did, they said, well, you know, you're not going to be able to work here anymore because you're in competition with our clients. We had clients in Charlevoix and, you know, it just was, I knew that that was what was going to happen. So a friend of mine was working at NPR that I had worked with at WAMU. And she said, why don't you come over here and fill in for us? Because we have someone who's going on maternity leave. Mm-hmm. So I started going to law school at night, working at NPR during the day. And I was they called it a desk assistant, which doesn't explain anything. But I had these huge Rolodexes. I mean, gigantic Rolodexes, like three of them. And my job, this was with All Things Considered. When the producers would decide what interviews the hosts were going to do, if they just had a subject, it was my job to find the exact right person to interview. So I would call different people and kind of pre-interview them and then pick out somebody. So it was a big responsibility.
Oh, yes.
Then, but I just loved it. I loved it. And I always had intended to come back to Michigan, though, at some point, because I really am totally a Michigan girl. After I graduated from law school, I came back here. I took the bar. The bar was horribly hard. I don't know if you know anyone who's taken it, but
I do.
It's really hard. I had to study, and I just thought, oh, it's summertime. It's so beautiful out, and here I am studying for the bar. Well, the day after I took the bar, NPR called and offered me a full-time job. I went right back there.
To Washington.
I never practiced law a day. But I am a member of the Michigan State Bar.
You are?
Yes.
So you passed the bar.
Passed it.
Hey, great.
You know, the one thing they tell you with the bar is you don't have to do well. You just have to pass.
Pass, yeah.
Yeah. So I went back to NPR, and now I was working as an assistant producer on All Things Considered.
Now, what are the duties of a producer?
A producer, when you're working with the show itself, we worked with the hosts. And so when the hosts would do interviews, you would sit there, you would do some research for them, you would watch the interview, help with it. But with those people, they were such pros, I wasn't really much help. But and then you would cut it. And at that time, we cut tape with razor blades. I mean, you would sit there with a 15-minute interview, cut it down to 5 minutes. And really, that's part of the reason that NPR programs are so good. because they're really highly produced. And it really makes a big difference. It's not listening to a live interview, which are great also, and sometimes the interviews were live, but everything is really like just the best stuff in the interview is put in. They just used to say, what's the rule? Keep the good stuff, throw out the bad stuff. So
you have to be able to choose what is the good stuff and what is the bad stuff.
Yeah, and the host really trusted you to do that. And when I was there, Susan Stamberg was still there for a little while. And I used to watch her do interviews. And she would be just like somebody you'd meet in a coffee shop or something, and she would sit there and chat with people. And she didn't act like she was a reporter or, you know, in some circles a famous radio host. She just was a normal person, and she would ask obvious questions and quirky questions, and she just had some of the best interviews you've ever heard. It was amazing.
You know, and this sounds silly in a way, but some people have told me that I sound like...
Yes!
I don't know why. It may be the New York accent.
It's a little bit the New York accent, but there's a sort of a pitch to your voice that's similar.
Yeah. It's funny that you... And I still hear her occasionally. She has pieces occasionally on NPR. Yes. So she must love it. She must have loved working for NPR.
Oh, yeah. Clearly. And she was really there from the beginning, and she kind of helped it along, you know, to become what it's become today.
So, and from there, you...
From there. Okay, so my intention always was to return to Michigan, and... I do love Michigan. Living in Washington was fun and exciting at times, but I really didn't want to spend the rest of my life there. And one day I was in the morning meeting for All Things Considered, and somebody dropped a newspaper in front of me, and it was Current, which is the industry newspaper for public broadcasting. And in it, they had a classified section, and it said... reporter position at WKAR in East Lansing. I looked at that and I just thought, I am going to get that job. I mean, just no question about it. Part of the reason I wanted to come back to Michigan, but I also was really longing to work at a station again because I really like the whole local feel of a station instead of a network. And the fact that you're covering and talking to people who are in your own community, that really adds so much meaning to what you do. And, you know, I was just so happy to come to Lansing. And
when was that? What year?
1990. Yeah. So, 23 years later.
You're still here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what were your duties at WKAR?
At first, I covered the Capitol. And we had a show called State Edition. All the stations had formed kind of a consortium to get Capitol coverage for all the stations in Michigan.
All of them, public radio?
No, just the public stations, all the public stations, similar to a network they have for the commercial stations. And at that time, we did pretty heavy Capitol coverage, and that continues to this day. We probably do more than the newspapers do at this point. And so I was covering the Capitol and state government, and we had a show on every day called State Edition that aired at quarter to five. And at 5 o'clock, All Things Considered started at 5 o'clock back then. That was before they started the 4 o'clock start. So we had a 15-minute show with statewide news, capital coverage, that kind of thing every day.
And so your job was to get the news and to report it live on WKAR.
Yeah, not live, really. Oh. I would usually...
You would tape it ahead.
Put together a feature and mix it and, yeah. Or yeah. Do an interview and it would be on tape, usually.
Yeah. So you learned a whole lot about state government.
Yes.
Too much?
I wasn't unhappy when I was reassigned. We got... we were able to increase the staff and we had someone else covering the Capitol, and I moved into doing features, which I love doing to this
day.
Explain
what that means.
Well, instead of having a regular beat, and in a way, I mean, sometimes I was assigned to do things, but a lot of times it was just whatever my interest was or my curiosity was. And I was kidded from the very beginning that I did have a beat, and it was Cops and Critters.
In that order?
Well, not really. I think, you know, I mean, I did do some stories about police issues and things like that. I covered, let's see, what did I do that was cops related? The one thing I remember really vividly is, do you remember the serial killer in Lansing, where at first there was a professor at LCC who was murdered in her office, and at first they arrested and convicted the wrong person and he was put into prison, but then the killings continued in a similar fashion, and they eventually, the man who was had been imprisoned was exonerated, and another man was arrested and convicted. Well, I covered that whole story from beginning to end, including the trial of the serial killer.
Oh, wow.
Who was, it was Matthew Macon, and he had killed several people. And, yeah.
Well, was, when was that?
I think it was 2007, maybe?
I guess I have the ability to obliterate things I don't,
right.
I don't want to remember
or
deal with.
Yeah. But I also did, you know, I love dogs, and so I did many dog stories.
Did you discriminate against cats?
Not really. I love cats, too, but I didn't find that many cat stories. But I would do stories with the Humane Society and animal control. I did a story about dog fighting in Lansing. Did you know that... you can find a dog fight almost any night in Lansing?
No. No, I didn't.
It's just
shocking. It is.
You may remember a few years ago there started to be some dogs who were abandoned, pit bulls. They would find them and they would be all beat up. Well, I did a story about dog fighting and actually a bunch of stories about it. But one of them was when... a particular dog had been found, and the officer who picked up the dog, it was his first day on the job, very young guy, and I went to interview him, and he cried during the, and it was just so sweet. I mean, he was just, when you see these dogs, you just can't help but just feel that this is so cruel. They're completely beat up, bitten, scarred, and really, most of them unadoptable because they're vicious and they're trained to be that way.
Right.
Yeah.
And you say it still goes on?
It still goes on, yeah.
It is illegal.
It is illegal. There are arrests, and they do a good job of trying to curtail it. And they have reward money for people who report any, like if you see someone who has a lot of dogs in their backyard or seems to have a lot of dogs, then you can report that anonymously and the police will investigate it. But I also did, you know, sort of very fun stories. One of them was about a bunch of people who had gotten a border collie as a dog, and they got them really because they've become kind of popular now. They're considered a cool dog to have. But once they got them, they realized they need so much activity. And so they got into herding and teaching their dogs to herd. Well, then, after a year or so of this, they decided they had to get their own sheep herd. And so these people ended up being farmers, you know, all right. Because of the dog, you know. They ended up moving outside to the country, getting a sheep herd, going to sheep herding trials. It changed their whole lives. And
that's fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. I border collies, collies in general, are not my favorite dog because they led, they herded a group of dogs. When we were at Yale, living in a graduate student community at Yale in the 1940s, late 1940s, and a collie herded the dogs outside and attacked our dog and almost killed it.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had to give the dog away because the veterinarian who took care of the dog said that that collie and his herd would not rest until they killed our dog. So ever
wow.
since, yes, so ever since, I am leery about collies. Anyway,
wow.
that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about some of the high points in your career at the station and some of the low points of your career at the station. And well, you told us some of the interesting parts, but was there any single high point that you can remember?
You know, well, you know, there were several hard stories to do, but several high points. What I realized after a while was that I really loved meeting people, and I would go out, you know, often and interview people and go to their homes or go to their farm or go to the, where they were working or whatever they were doing. And I would sometimes get really obsessed with certain stories because I would be so touched. And I remember, I think it was Mr. Rogers on his show. I used to love to watch Mr. Rogers. He said, and I'm going to misquote him, he said, "You can't help but fall in love with someone once you know their story." And when I heard him say that, I realized that that was kind of what was happening to me. Like, I would talk to people, and I would kind of fall in love with them. And, you know, you would interview them because they were doing something for a reason. And you would find out what that reason was. And mm-hmm. a lot of times it was, you know, to help their community or whatever, but there was also a personal reason, too. And one example of this is I did stories about the concentrated animal farms that were built around the Irish Hills south of here, this beautiful area, beautiful farming area. And many of the farmers who were not doing concentrated animal farms, who'd been there for years, were really fighting the whole proliferation of these farms because, first of all, it stank. And there you couldn't really go outside without smelling the manure and, you know, the smell of these places. And on really bad days, if it was windy or humid or something, you could actually sort of feel the yuckiness of, you know, all this waste that these animals were producing. And also they didn't like the fact that animals were being treated like this also as well. They had more traditional farms where their animals were grazing, and it had also come to the point where it had ruined their property values. They couldn't sell their farms. The only people they could sell it to were the people who wanted to put another CAFO in there. And so when I went down and talked to these people, I mean, some of them were very elderly, and they didn't even want to go out of their homes anymore, let alone farm there, because the whole, you know, it was just a really awful atmosphere. And so I made several excuses to just go down there a lot and visit with them. They also had a lot of trucks running back and forth on their country roads, and that it was, it just wasn't a quiet place anymore, what they, you know, what they loved. And so I sort of figured out a lot of different ways of covering that story just so I could go down there and visit with them, because they were very, very sincere about really trying to fight this. And they eventually went through the DEQ because...
The DEQ.
The Department of Environmental Quality, because they were... the farms were really contaminating the rivers and streams and water supply and stuff around there. But they never really had much luck. They continue to fight to try to regulate these farms, and it just wasn't going to happen because the retailers sort of demanded all the products that these CAFOs were producing. So, yeah.
Did you... keep up your friendship with some of these old farmers?
Yeah, absolutely. I found that farmers really love what they do, and there's obviously so many different farming issues in Michigan. Yeah, there's one place, Titus Farms. They really benefited by the whole rise in popularity of farmers markets. And they started producing in the wintertime. They built hoop houses and would grow stuff. And I could see how hard they worked. One of the quotes I got when I did a story about their hoop houses, one of the farmers said, "This is not for the faint-hearted." You're like, no, it isn't. It's a lot of hard work. Yeah. And so I became a member of their... they have a, you can buy in a partnership and get your vegetables. And they continued it all winter, too, which is great.
I know that they have, I'm able to buy their products at the Meridian Farmers Market.
Yeah.
Jams, they have jam.
They have great jams, don't they?
I know.
Yeah.
Well, that was a high point and several high points. Were there any low points? I mean, things that really...
Low points.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It's so funny. I can't think of any real...
Oh, good.
...low points. I'll tell you a scary story, though.
Oh, okay.
I went to... I went up to Canada working on a story. I don't know if you remember this, but many years ago, the Canadian government granted permission to a company to take water out of Lake Superior and ship it to China. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And one of the Inuit tribes up there sued the government and said that Mother Nature had decreed that this belonged to the Inuit and they were to fish, and taking water out of Lake Superior would not be what Mother Nature had intended. And so I went up there to actually interview someone from the tribe, and it was up near Wawa in Ontario. And he took me out to Lake Superior where these Indians were getting ready to go out fishing, and I was going to go with them. Well, I got one look at that. They had these rickety old wooden boats, and of course, Lake Superior, of course, it was a windy, stormy day, but I had come all this way, so out I went, and I was going to interview them, you know, while we were out there. Well, it was so rocky and, you know, just so scary. I was wondering if I was going to get back alive, that I couldn't think about doing an interview. And it just was just like hanging on for dear life. And when we finally got back to the dock, then I said, okay, well, now we can sit here and do the interview. Well, they didn't want to be interviewed. They didn't want to talk. They hardly talked the whole time we were there. So I had gone out and done this whole thing and didn't get one bite out of it.
Yeah.
But I did talk to someone else from the tribe, and I talked to their attorney also. Yeah. And you know what? The Canadian government reneged that permit.
Oh.
They took it back, and that was the end of it.
So they won.
They
won. That's a rare case where they won. Yes.
Yes. There was so much public pressure.
Yeah.
And I think that anyone trying to take water out of the Great Lakes is going to, I don't know, who knows, though.
And water is becoming an increasingly precious commodity.
Yeah, yeah.
So is this the first time you're at the other end of an interview?
Yes, it is.
Tell me, how does it feel?
Well, it's okay. I feel a little bit like I'm babbling, but
no,
it's fine.
No.
It's fine. I'm okay with it. I do feel like asking you questions instead, though.
Well, as I like to say, I ask the questions. I used to tell that to my students, too. When and why did you retire?
I retired a couple of years ago, and the reason I retired was because I had always wanted to make films, and I had done a couple of TV projects for WKAR and realized how little I really knew about making a film, and that there was a lot to learn about it. And so I decided that if there was ever a time I was going to do it, I'd better do it now. So, and I was eligible for retirement, which was wonderful. And so I retired and I started going to Lansing Community College, which has a fabulous film program. They call it digital media now. It's all digital. And I have really learned a lot. But one of the things I wanted to do, I've always been really into doing interviews, is to do interviews, and it's not going to be on film, technically. It'll be on digital video. But to learn how to do it so that I could pick the setting, do the lighting, and interview people. Some of the people that I've already done stories about, some people that I know who have interesting things to say, kind of like what you're doing. I mean, you just find that there's a lot there, and I really love the sort of art of interviewing as well. And one of the things I've thought about doing, which people have asked me to do, is to interview their elderly relatives and mix it with photographs or B-roll or whatever, so that they can have this as kind of a keepsake to show other people who may not have ever met that person, you know, grandkids and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking forward to doing that. I've got a group of students organized, and we're going to do an independent study in the fall just focused on interviews. And so we can learn how to do it. Because you do practice it, but there's a lot to it in terms of the setting that you pick and how you light it, and then interviewing techniques. And,
I'm sure.
And
I'm
then
sure.
Editing.
Yes. And look, I've given you the opportunity to feel it, what an interview is like from the other side.
Yeah,
of the mic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And did you feel that as a reporter, et cetera, on WKAR, you were really an integral part of the university?
You know, I guess I would have to say not really an integral part of the university. It felt more like I was part of the community, the Lansing, East Lansing region and the state. I mean, we did cover a lot of things going on at MSU because there are a lot of interesting things there. And we were, at times, the station was not, was in different departments. And so we never really got dug into any particular department. But we were in the building with Communication Arts and Sciences. So we did get to know professors there and, you know, different people with Comm Arts. But I think it was somewhat separate, our day-to-day activities, really.
So what do you see as the role of public radio, not only in the Michigan State University community, but the wider community as well?
I think that public radio, which, you know, many, many times the demise of radio has been predicted, and it just doesn't happen. And public radio has become so popular. I mean, NPR has fabulous programs. The local stations are all very diverse in what they do. WKAR still has classical music programming, which is very well supported in this community. And it's fabulous because a lot of stations have had to give it up. But, you know, as long as we can last with classical music, I think it's great. The role, I think, now, which has changed quite a bit, is to cover the news and do it internationally, national, state, local, because newspapers aren't doing so well. I mean, they are facing a lot of challenges that public radio is not. And I think, you know, I read newspapers, and when I'm at LCC, the students there kid me because they say I'm the last person who actually reads a paper newspaper. But there's a lot of news online, but there's something so unique about radio in that you can listen to it in your car, you can listen to it while you're doing other things, you know, doing the dishes, making dinner, you know, and they really have fabulous news coverage on NPR, and it has really improved over the years.
So you think the quality of what they offer is very high?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Do you have any present relationship to Michigan State?
Not formally, no. But I do keep up with my friends at WKAR. And I do go to some of the community events that they have when I can, whenever I can, actually. They have the community cinema there with panel discussions, and those are just great. Yeah, I just love it. But I do come over on campus and ride my bike.
Well, that's one way.
And show people around the campus when they come to visit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yeah. What are your present interests, and I think you've touched on them so far, aside from Michigan State?
Yeah. Oh, I do have to mention, I do fundraise on WKAR occasionally. Yes. What are my present interests? I am mostly, I think, it's the focus on learning film. And it's been difficult because a lot of what I do is now done on computer programs, editing video and audio. Even in the pre-production stages, there are computer programs that help you storyboard and write your scripts. And I'm of that generation, which, as you know, we didn't grow up with computers, so there's a learning curve there. And I've been trying to overcome that learning curve and learning how to do that.
Are you finding that difficult?
It is difficult, but I'm kind of over the hump now. But I've been taking classes for 2 years, so I've really had to apply myself to it and really, really work at it. But I think I realize now that I can do it. It's not impossible. You just have to study.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And practice. Yeah.
And do you have any concrete plans for your future relationship with Michigan State?
Well, I plan to continue to have a relationship with WKER and to help with fundraising. And I do suggest story ideas for some of the reporters over there sometimes. But I really love living in the MSU community and taking advantage of all the things that MSU has to offer. And I think it's a great place to live. It's a wonderful little town. I used to call it East Cupcake because it was such a sweet place to live.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear from an alumna from the University of Michigan.
That's right, and I root for Spartans now. So.
Oh, well, you've really made the grade.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about? Anything at all?
Oh, gosh, I don't think so. This was more grueling than I thought it was going to be.
Really?
Well, I didn't know what we were going to go for an hour or so. That's really a long time. Because in radio, if we do 15 minutes, we know we have to cut it down to 4 or 5 minutes. So,
yeah. We're not cutting any of this.
I know. No, it's been great, though. Your questions were wonderful.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.